Bacon. Are you ready, Alabama?
Hello? What, who's there? What's going on?
It's time to enter the doghouse.
Whatever's happening here, just knock it off.
Call the big dog now at 866-485-9867.
These kids are weird, man. They're weird.
Live from the Big Dog Production Studios.
How you doing?
It's the Tom Abraham Show.
That might be listed in Revelations as the cause for the apocalypse.
Here he is, the head of the household, the Big Dog.
You're the smartest guy I've ever met.
Tom Abraham.
You want me to do this crap?
I guess I'm on here. Am I on? Can somebody respond?
Sounds like Cube's going to talk Alabama tomorrow morning. But our friend Mark Burnett, huh? I mean, I'm not sure. I just heard, you know, I think that was the point he was trying to make. I think he was saying it. He talks Alabama, doesn't he? I mean, we talk Auburn. He talks Alabama. Does he have to make a big deal about it when he's gonna? Are you guys busting his stones? Is that what's going on? Is somebody busting Cube's stones to the point where he's got to make a big deal out of the fact that he's going to talk Alabama football? He talks Alabama football. What's the matter with you people? Stop it. What day is it? I'm totally lost. I mean, I've been on the fly all day. I'm totally lost. What day is it today?
Uh-oh.
Oh, it's that day? I didn't know it was that day.
Uh-oh.
I've been in Huntsville. I've been running around all over the place.
Uh-oh.
And now I know what day it is.
Uh-oh. Guess what day it is.
Friggin' hump day.
Guess what day it is.
We're doing stuff for tomorrow.
Anybody? Mike.
Hump
what
day.
Day is it, Mike? Leslie, guess what today is?
It's hump day.
Hump day.
Woo-hoo!
That's right, hump day. And then tomorrow, there's afternoon baseball, so we're only going to be with you at the end, like the 5 o'clock hour. We'll probably just have the highly sought after 5 o'clock hour for you tomorrow. Who knows? There was a rumor that I'm going to be on the Cube show tomorrow morning. I mean, maybe not. Maybe, you know, I was asked to join them from Titans camp tomorrow morning, where T-Mac and I will be at practice. I was asked by the producer of the Cube show and sometimes sidekick and co-host. And, you know, so I have to get T-Mac to bump my elbow or something at 9:25 or 9:40 or whenever it was that they wanted to do that. And, you know, we'll do a hit with them. It is an eclectic hump day in the doghouse. We got plenty of football, naturally. A little baseball in here. We got some hoop in here. Plus whatever else falls out, like a little boxing maybe, where the Nevada Boxing Commission approved a request for 8-ounce gloves to be used instead of the standard 10-ounce gloves that are used for bouts involving fighters over 147 pounds. The issue came to light August 1st when Floyd wrote on his Facebook page, quote, "Let's fight in 8-ounce gloves." Mayweather has fought the majority of his career in 8-ounce gloves, but he was going to have to fight this fight at 10-ounce gloves. McGregor, who, of course, is the lightweight champion from the UFC, he uses 4-ounce gloves in that mixed martial arts deal. So both fighters signed off on this. They both submitted a waiver to the commission, for Nevada Athletic Commission, requesting the smaller glove size. Now, as an advantage, if you want to try and figure out who does this benefit, well, look, both guys wanted it. So they must both think it's good for them. I mean, money doesn't knock a lot of guys out no matter what size gloves he's wearing. He could be wearing them Dan Marino isotoner gloves. He's not knocking a lot of guys out. And so maybe him having a lighter glove brings a little bit more oomph to that punch. So maybe that helps him. I'm not sure. As for McGregor, he's clearly the brawler in this deal, so it enhances the puncher's chance, which is likely the only chance he's got. I'm going to end up buying this fight. I know I'm going to do it. I don't want to drop the C note on it, but I'm going to end up doing it. Between me and my four sons, I'm going to end up buying this fight. I know it. I just know it's going to happen. What do you do? I mean, what do you do? It's a C note. I'm going to drop a C note on this freaking circus. I know I will. I'm going to get caught up in it, and I'm going to drop a C note on this thing. McGregor says that if we're in 8-ounce gloves, that Mayweather will be floored multiple times in the first round. Mayweather will be floored multiple times in the first round. LeVar Ball thinks this guy's full of crap. He said, I believe first round KO in 8-ounce gloves. The fact that I can't follow through like an MMA and pound the head into the canvas because there's a 10 count in boxing, I'll give him the second round. So with 8-ounce gloves, he'll be done in 2 rounds. Mayweather's not saying anything about it. Mayweather's people says that Floyd wants Conor to be as comfortable as possible. Whatever Conor wants, as comfortable as possible, so there won't be any excuses. Conor has vowed that he'll knock out Floyd in 4 rounds. He recently corrected that and said if the commission approved 8-ounce gloves, he doesn't give Floyd 2 rounds. I have no reason to believe that he's not feeling very confident. I want him to continue to have that confident attitude. So we'll see. Now, look, they're not using the Mexican horsehair gloves. I mean, let's just get that cleaned up right away. I'm not being racist. That's what they're called, Mexican horsehair gloves. It says in the story, another concern regarding glove selection was the distribution of padding. The bout contracts mandate foam gloves be used, not the Mexican horsehair gloves, which are no more as puncher's gloves. Oh, they're hard like rocks. Now, are they? Why are they Mexican horsehair gloves? Are American horsehair is not as strong as Mexican horsehair? Are they horsehair gloves that are made in Mexico or that the Mexicans use, so that's why they're Mexican horsehair gloves? Or are they from Mexican horses? That's what I want to know. Is it because is it Mexican horses? Or is it because it's horsehair gloves that are made in Mexico? I don't know.
Look, I don't speak Spanish.
I don't. So I don't know. I mean, there's nobody I can ask. Maybe T-Mac knows because he's got a little bit of that in him.
I don't speak Spanish.
I don't. He doesn't either, probably. Maybe he does. Who knows? All right, so that story's out there. A late-breaking story into the show. How about this? Did you see what's going on in Los Angeles with the L.A. We Don't Want to Be Here Chargers? They're offering free tattoos to generate some fan interest in the City Angels. I mean, yeah, they announced that the season is sold out. I understand that. They're playing in a 27,000-seat soccer stadium. Oh, the season's sold out! You know, a ton of those are business packages, not real fans. And it's 27,000 seats. You know what they call that in Texas? Friday Night Lights. That's high school football, 27,000 seats. But what's even worse, did you see what happened on Sunday night? Only 21,000 people showed up for the first preseason game for the Los Angeles Chargers, who started out in Los Angeles and played 1 year there in 1960 before moving in 61 to San Diego, where they've been for 55 years. So 21,000 people bother to go to the game. They get shellacked 48-17 by Seattle. And what's even worse, the soccer team outdrew them by 4,500 the day before. The soccer team. This is a bad idea. This is a bad, look, for 55 years they were the San Diego Chargers. Get your ass back down there before it's too late. Get back down to Tijuana. Get down there. Go. 21,000 people. UAB will average that many this season. 21,000 people. What do I say? There's that many people in the bathroom at an Alabama game. Are you kidding me? UAB! So, hey, go ahead. Get your Charger tat. Just make sure it's just the bolt. You know what I mean? Don't get no Los Angeles. Just get like a bolt. How many people will be driving up from San Diego? Just get a bolt or just Chargers. But don't no L.A. Don't get any L.A. thing on there. This is a bad idea, man. This 21,000 on the first game. It's a bad idea. It's a soccer stadium. It's a little tiny soccer stadium. The other shoe has dropped on Hugh Freeze's pattern of inappropriate behavior. According to the Wall Street Journal's Andrew Beaton, Hugh Freeze apparently would call hookers from his Ole Miss issued company phone whenever he was on like a recruiting trip. The plane that was used to take Freeze to Tampa touched down just hours before that 1 minute call. You know, the mistake and a buck call. It was a buck call, all right. The booty call. It's a different kind of buck call. Previously, it was classified as a potential missed dial. Oh, yeah. A few hours after the plane touched down at 5:30 in Tampa, his school phone registered a call to a number linked to a female escort city or service in Tampa, according to the phone records reviewed by the Journal. The Ole Miss athletic director, Ross Bjork, opened up to the Wall Street Journal, clearing up some of the vagueness from the initial press conference. He said in response to questions from the Journal about Freeze's travel that the university's investigation uncovered calls of a similar nature over the course of several years, you hypocrite, often matching up with travel logs showing the coach's use of the school plane. The school said it examined his travel logs from peak recruiting times, November, December, January, when Freeze would travel out of state using the school plane and other public resources. When we say pattern, we're describing other phone numbers. Other phone numbers that when you Google them, they pull up similar types of web services, websites. However you would describe them, we took action quickly. Oh, my gosh, this is bad. Just gets worse and worse. Look, that's got to be a kind of a sickness, right? I mean, because you're the head football coach at a major university and a dream job making $4.5 million a year. And you go on a recruiting trip and you're calling hookers. I mean, it's got to be pretty bad to screw that gig up. That's a dream gig. It's crazy. Another solid outing for Sonny Gray last night. His ninth straight outing for the kid out of Smyrna, Tennessee, Vanderbilt product. His ninth straight outing of at least six innings and allowing two runs or less. And this time the Yankees actually gave him some run support. He earned his first win for the Yankees. The guy hadn't had a win yet for the Yankees in his previous couple of starts. As the Yanks swept the two games that were at Yankee Stadium. Tonight they'll pick it up over in Queens. Play two more against the Mets over there. You know, Jacob DeGrom, like the last man standing for the Mets, all those great pitchers they had, they all got injured. He was just humming along until Jacoby Ellsbury came up and.
And the pitch is driven to deep right field, high enough. Yes, it's gone. A bullet home run over the auxiliary scoreboard in right center. Jake Ells buries it in the right field seats.
Jake Ells buries it. All right. 2 innings later, the Santino
got the 1-0.
Swung on, and there goes deep left. It is high. It is far. It is gone. Gary Sanchez drove one in the seats and left over the auxiliary scoreboard. The Santino.
Yeah, the Santino got loose. And then Aroldis Chapman came in and tried to blow this one again. Made it interesting. Allowed a two-run homer to a 21-year-old kid by the name of Ahmed Rosario, who just came up a few weeks ago. And then he hung on for the 5-4 win. Remember, Sunday it was that 21-year-old kid from Boston raking in the ninth versus Chapman. These young guys are not intimidated by the 103-mile-an-hour fastball, apparently. Red Sox won as well. Also, by the way, homering was Giancarlo Stanton again. That guy, can't believe his home run is not on my cut service. I thought for sure that the Giancarlo Stanton home run would be on the cut service. How could you not put that one on the cut service? Any other good home runs? I wonder what this home run call sounds like. Ryder Jones, San Francisco.
Fastball is driven down the right field line deep toward the corner. It is hooking. It is
gone.
A home run. Oh. Ryder Jones. It was a question of fair or foul, and it stayed fair.
Yes, that's John Miller. I wish he'd go back to ESPN. I wish they put him back on the Sunday night game. John Miller. I didn't like Joe Morgan on the game. John Miller was classic, though. Absolutely classic. Yeah, that's John Miller. He's the voice of the Giants. All right, we'll do one more home run call. Carlos Santana.
Swung on, smoke to deep right field. This ball is gone. A two-run home run to right. Santana has his second bomb of the night. And it's 8-1 Indians.
Can you imagine if he was a Yankee what John Sterling would do with Carlos Santana hitting home runs? That's crazy. All right, if you got an idea what you want to contribute to the show, we invite you to get in toll-free, 866-485-9867. Digital Doghouse is open. Twitter feed is at Tom Abraham Show. You can hit us with a follow. Facebook fan page, throw us a like. Facebook / Tom Abraham Show. Text window 7329-TA-SHOW, 732-982-7469. Doghouse inbox is open, tom@tomabraham.com. Going to kick things off today with a little Pac-12 talk with Anthony Heron. Well, it's not going to be Pac-12 talk necessarily. A little bit. Then into three, Alan Carpenter from TomahawkTake.com is in. Braves won yesterday. He's followed by David Moulton from SiriusXM's College Sports Nation and the SEC on CBS, where he works the booth alongside Gary Danielson. David will be with us throughout the season as well. In the four, Matt Scalise from AL.com is in. Then we'll get our hoop on with Bo Estes from NBATV.com. A lot of newsy things coming out of the association. So that's in there as well. The man behind the curtain playing the stacks of wax, the platters that matter, answering those phones, pushing those buttons, wishing that he still had cream around. You know what I'm talking about. His family calls him Antonio Macbeth. To us, he's simply the one and only. The only guy we offered the job.
There was no doubt about who I was going to hire. Didn't interview anybody, didn't talk to anybody, just hired a guy.
Just hired a guy just like that. Stony Man.
Chico, don't be discouraged. The man, he ain't so hard to understand.
Kiss my brown ass.
Do you know who I am?
Who in the blue hell are you?
I'm the producer of this show. If I didn't step up, you're nowhere. I put this thing together out of spit and polish.
You want me on that wall. You need me on that wall.
I don't know how to say this, so I'm going to choose my words very carefully. I think you're a psycho.
You don't ever say that to me. Bullcrap.
I don't care how many Dago, Guinea, Wok, Greaseball, Goombas come out of the woodwork.
All those of you that know Italians and like Italians, this is your day.
You can't speak Italian just because you have a mustache.
How come there ain't no Puerto Ricans on Star Trek?
When you ask me those kind of questions, it really pisses me off.
We love you. We love you forever and ever.
Say hello to my new friend.
Hey, T-Mac, how you doing today?
Big Dog, I am fan-freaking-tastic today. I'm excited about going to practice tomorrow. I get to go up. It gives me an excuse tonight to go up and see my parents. Don't get to see them too often, so I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm pumped up for it as well, and we'll have a good time up there at practice tomorrow morning. It'll be good. It's going to be a little bit like old home week. You know, we're going to meet up at my old radio station and head over there because it's right across the street from the facility. So I'm just telling you, just be prepared for that. It might be a little bit like old home week over there.
That's totally fine. And gives me a chance being right next to you, people coming up and saying hi, I get to introduce myself and kind of network. Yeah. It's a chance to network a little bit. So
could happen a little bit. Yeah, we'll have to see. It might happen a little bit. All right, tell me something that I didn't know. Give me a little maneuver here. What do you got?
I got a little something for you. We're going to start at 1927. That's right, 1927, the first home run was hit out of Comiskey Park in Chicago. And can you guess who hit it out?
The Kringleberry.
Babe Ruth. Close.
Oh.
Close. It was Babe Ruth hit the first home run out of Comiskey Park, Chicago. I believe that park has been closed for some time now. 1981, the highest score in a World Cup soccer match, New Zealand beat Fiji 13-0.
Wow, that's even worse than when the amazing Germans won 7-0 against Brazil.
Yeah, 13-0. 1997, for only the second time, the Stanley Cup leaves North America and heads to Russia. That's right. I'm still getting ready to research the first time and why they left. But for the second time only, the Stanley Cup left North America for Russia. 2015, wow. Jason Day won the 97th PGA Championship, setting the major record at 20 under par at Whistling Straits just a couple years ago. I remember that one. And one birthday today, and that is 1983. Colt Brennan was born. That's right. He, I believe, still a backup for the Redskins now. He's 34. He played his college ball at Hawaii, where I believe he's... My goodness, top three in most career passing yards. Just going off memory here, it just hit in my head. I believe he's top three.
Well,
all
I think
time
when he left, wasn't he number one when he left? I think when he left, he was number one. You know, at that point.
Let's see here, most college career passing yards. I believe you're right. Because, yeah, nope. Let's see, Timmy Chang was number one, I believe, when he left, and then Case Keenum beat him out.
So you got that 13-0.
Ridiculous, man.
World Cup game in there. But look, I think Brazil getting beat 7-0. I mean, it's Brazil, for God's sakes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
By
right.
The Germans. You remember when that happened. Mm. And since you put it into minutia, have you heard it? My mashup? You got to hear it.
Hit
Come
it
on.
Is it good soccer call?
Julio Cesar to his left. Another World Cup goal for Thomas Muller. And Germany leads in the 11th minute. Miroslav Klose on his own rebound. Sets the record in Brazil. Tied with the great Ronaldo, a Brazilian, who sees his record go away. 3-0 Germany. He beats Julio Cesar to Julio Cesar's right. It's 4-0. You've got to be kidding. What's Brazil doing? They scored again. 5-0. Cross quick shot the goal. And he drives it off the crossbar and in. 7-0. Wow.
Wow. Wow.
We'd be here all day if you mashed up at 13-0.
This is just from, it's probably not audio from that one. Right. That was the last World Cup, remember?
Yeah.
Out of Brazil.
I remember that. That was absolutely insane. That's why this 13-0 hit me even more. But I want to correct myself before we move on. Colt Brennan did play at Hawaii, but he is 7th all-time in passing yards. The one I was thinking of being in the top three from Hawaii is Timmy Chang. When he left in 04, he was number one to be passed up in 2011 by Case Keenum.
So who was number one when he left? Colt Brennan or Timmy Chang?
Timmy Chang was number one when he left.
Okay.
Colt Brennan never got there.
He never got there. Okay. All right. All right, man. Well, that's a good job by you. Let's get a break in here. When we come back, Anthony Heron will join us. We'll talk some football with Big Ant. That's coming up next. We got this one rolling. It's a hump day in the doghouse right here at 7:30, 103.9. The Hump.
No time to get on the phone? Tweet the Big Dog at Tom Abraham Show. Here's Tom Abraham.
Welcome back, Tom Abraham Show. their football conversation started with Anthony Herron, who does a tremendous job for the Pac-12 Network. He does other things as well, covering college football. He played in the Big Ten at Iowa. He played in the NFL, and he lives in Chicago, so he's in that neck of the woods, and he joins us now on the Woody Anderson Ford VIP Hotline. Big Ant, welcome to the show, man. How are you?
Big Diggity. I'm doing great, man. Just packing my bags, getting ready to hit the road again. I'm going to head out to, well, I got to fly into Spokane, Washington, because I'm going to go check out Washington State at their football practice tomorrow. But there's not any really close airports to Pullman that'll fly me cross country to get there. So I got to fly into Spokane. Then I got a little drive after that. But it's always nice driving through that Pacific Northwest. It's a nice part of the country to see this time of year.
Yeah, that's what I understand. It's really pretty. I have yet to be out there. I got family in Oregon, and I got family. My sister lives in Utah, and I've been to Utah once to do an arena game, but I haven't been out further, you know, past there. And I understand that Upper Midwest Northwest is just absolutely gorgeous.
It really is. It's a cool part of the nation, and also just calling a football game there is different. Like, you know, you call the game in Salt Lake City when you're calling arena football, so there's a different type of energy in the building. But most, I guess, from a spectacular standpoint, just in the broadcast booth, when you're calling games out on the West Coast, you know, call them in the Big Ten and call them down south and call them on the East Coast. But out West, you're looking out from the broadcast booth, and it's one thing you're seeing these great, majestic stadiums and whatnot. But, you know, some of these schools out in Pac-12 country, you're looking at mountains out, you know, just outside the stadium, and snow caps here and there. And,
yeah,
you know, like University of Washington in Seattle, they're right there on Lake Washington. And I haven't been to Knoxville yet, even though I lived there in Nashville for a few years, but I never did make it over to Knoxville to see a game in Tennessee. But Seattle has a setup where folks can take the boat right up to Husky Stadium when they're going to one of the games for the Washington Huskies. So it's just some really cool atmosphere and landscapes out there.
Yeah, they got the Vol Navy that pulls up there on the Tennessee River right outside the stadium. I mean, it's literally maybe, I don't know, a couple hundred yard walk to the stadium and everybody kind of ties up together. It's like a, you know, it's kind of like a redneck yacht club. You know what I mean? They just tie boat to boat to boat to boat. You can walk all across them and all that kind of good stuff. But when you're in the stadium, you don't see the river. You don't see anything. You know what I mean? These stadiums, some of these stadiums down south, they're just so huge. I couldn't even tell you. You know, if you're at Jordan-Hare, if you're at in Tuscaloosa, if you're, you know, up there at the Neyland Stadium, as they say, you really don't see anything. You know what I mean? It's just like the stadiums are so massive. All you can see is the field, and you know, so it's a little bit of a different feel. But yeah, I've seen, especially University of Washington. They say that's one of the most beautiful settings in the country. That and BYU, which as well, which they say is absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, I've heard great things about BYU. You know, I've called games for Utah and Utah State just in my travels out west, doing some games out there. I have yet to call a BYU game, and that one, from what I understand as well, it's got almost a service academy kind of look to it, where I've called games for Air Force there, or, you know, whether Air Force or Colorado State, been to Fort Collins and Colorado Springs and that whole state of Colorado. You got the snow caps and everything in the distance. But, yeah, I've heard great things about BYU. But you mentioned Washington. And just the fact that not only can they ride the boats up to the stadium, but you do have, especially because there's an open part of the stadium that overlooks Lake Washington. And so kind of like if you go to a Bears game here in Chicago, or if you go to like Fenway Park in Boston, and so you kind of have the city landscape that you're seeing just outside the stadium, you know, kind of conversely to that, in Seattle there at Husky Stadium, you're seeing Lake Washington. And, you know, so you're just seeing the boats out there in this large, majestic body of water, so as opposed to seeing a skyline with the skyscrapers, which is cool in certain aspects when you're actually in a major city. This is Husky Stadium, which is in a major city. It's in Seattle, but you're not looking at the skyline of Seattle. You're looking at Lake Washington. It's a really cool atmosphere for a game.
Anthony Herron with us. I was thinking about you a little bit. I was watching some videos, Ryan Abraham, a guest of the show from time to time, that covers USC. And I was watching some of the practice videos, and I love drills. You know, I'm just a guy that loves drills, you know, the nuts and bolts of it. And I've talked about the fumble drill recently. In fact, I think we're going to do a little Coach's Corner segment this fall and talk about some different things. But I saw a drill and coaches are so inventive. But I saw a drill that the running backs were doing, and I got to be honest with you, I hadn't seen this one before. You know, I thought, you know, you think you've seen a lot of it or all of it, and I had not seen this one before. the USC running backs were doing a grass drill. I've seen that where they're, you know, carrying the ball, 3 points of pressure, and they're chopping their feet, and they're going down in between the cones, shuffling and doing kind of hit-its, you know, doing a grass drill. But the coach, the ball that they had, the coach had a stick with a string that was attached to the ball, and he was jerking at the ball, trying to pull the ball out as they were doing the grass drill. I don't know, man. Maybe I missed some. I hadn't seen that one before. That was a pretty cool drill.
They're getting more and more inventive with these. And David McCullough is the running back coach for USC, and he's a young, energetic sort of guy who's done some good things in the coaching ranks. And he got some talented running backs there for the Trojans also. And I've seen this more and more with the, you know, put the football on a stick and do different things with it, whether it's having, you know, when you're doing fumble drills. I've seen some teams, even in this training camp tour, I've seen some teams doing fumble drills where you're able to kind of yank the ball away at the last second, or even once the player actually engages the ball, then at that point, you know, during a fumble drill, you try to start yanking it away. And just the possession of the football being so vital and so important, you're seeing that emphasized at a higher level. I'd say that's one thing from a practice standpoint where, you know, from a macro standpoint, we kind of see that, yeah, teams are less physical on the practice field now. There's not as much hitting, not as much live tackling. But just from a focus standpoint, one of the things I'd say I've really noticed over the past 5 years have been teams finding ways to make sure players are emphasizing the way they protect the football. But then most especially the bigger leap I've seen at the collegiate level is teams emphasizing various drills to put their defensive players in the mind of takeaways. And it's part of why I love to use the term takeaways as opposed to turnovers when I'm talking about defensive guys, because you need to have your players and your staff in the mentality of not just waiting for a turnover to happen, but to be in a mentality of forcing takeaways from the opponent. So I think a lot of staffs around the country are doing a much better job of that in recent years, is not just securing the tackle, not just being in the proper position, but how do we actually get the football away and take possessions from our opponent?
Did you guys do – let's see, you were in – what was your senior year, 2000, 99? 2009. Okay, so you were wrapping up just – you actually were a freshman in my last couple of years of coaching. And we did turnover drills every day. We had gotten them from the Cowboys. And you know, when I was doing linebackers, first defensive lineman and then linebackers and coordinating special teams, you know, when we did our fundamental period at the start of every practice – we did fumble drills in terms of how to properly recover a fumble in a fetal position. And then when I had linebackers, we did the scoop and score thing where you drop your hips and I bounce the ball on the ground and, you know, drop your hips and scoop it and that kind of stuff. And then the second guy in stripping to punch out from behind and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Did you guys do that? And when you were playing at Iowa, did you do that on a daily basis? Or, cause I know at Alabama, they still do it every single day. They work on getting the ball out.
We did, and it's more focused in a way on the offensive side of it was always kind of my experience. You know, where defenders, like you mentioned, we'd come in and punch the ball out from behind. You know, the guy would simulate being the ball carrier, and he's got his points of pressure and, you know, high and tight, and he's carrying it. And then you try to punch it out, you try to rake it down from behind. I feel like the way that the different takeaway drills are simulated and emphasized on the defensive side are in much more depth now than it ever was before, especially just kind of traveling around, getting to watch so many teams practice over the years that I've been in the broadcast industry. So I'd say the last 5 to 7 years, I've seen a big uptick in not just teams doing, you know, kind of those couple of drills. Let's just kind of have our quick possession circuit, and a lot of it is maybe focused on the offensive side. I've seen now where multiple periods in practice or even days that are themed around, you know, takeaway Tuesday, those types of things where it's about the whole defense being focused on every time a running back finishes, you go in, try to poke away at the football. Or here's the second time we're going through some sort of a takeaway circuit within the same practice. And it's just this focus on maintaining and gaining additional possessions in the game, because the tempo of college football has picked up so much and there's so many additional possessions, and it's getting harder and harder, it seems, to actually try to stop somebody and keep them out of the end zone. So I'm seeing more and more teams now really, in a way, I guess, overemphasize how you take the football away from the opponent. I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, and the other thing that I see emphasized more than ever now is scoring the ball. I mean, it used to be, you always said, you know, we're going to return it to the near sideline. You know, wherever that near sideline is, that's where, you know, set up and block to the inside. But you didn't really drill it as much. But I see now more than ever, almost like a special teams period, that teams are really drilling the return game on a turnover. I mean, where guys are really learning how to block and not hold and do the different things. They know that they can't cut block and stuff like that. But, it looks like a sophisticated return. You always got to put two guys on the intended receiver. It's of an interception. He's closest to the ball. I used to tell my guys, you got to put two guys on the quarterback too, because, he's like the safety today. You might have to put two guys on the quarterback just to make sure we get him controlled. But that's what it seems like. I'm seeing a lot of really, really drilling, taking it to the house.
And the choreography of that moment is just one element of situational football, because for coaches, they're trying to put their players in as active a simulated position as they can, so then the guy's comfortable when he actually gets out there in a live game scenario. So for defenders, let's say you play 10 possessions of defense in a given game. And, most of those are likely to end with the offense either punting the ball away or having an opportunity to score some sort of points. Only a few of those you really have a legitimate shot where it's actually going to end in a takeaway. So let's say even in a great game, if you play 10 possessions of defense and three of them, maybe even four of them, end in a takeaway, you have to take advantage of those opportunities at such a high level. So, yeah, you're right, where it goes beyond now just the fumble recovery drill or the scoop and score drill. It's all right, all 11 players on defense on the field at the same exact moment. And now that we've secured an interception and we got the OSCE call going, but not just focusing on everybody run to the end zone, focusing on here's your assignment when you're in a particular area of the field. And here's my guy who's assigned to the quarterback. And you're not allowed to just cream the quarterback at this point anymore. You have to make sure you block him legally, don't pick up a penalty. You guys, since you're near the ball, now you're the players who are kind of the vice guys, where you're going to lead this guy. You're going to, help create the lead blocker, the caravan that works up the sideline. If you're in a position near the interception, you're the crackback person. Don't block low. And go through all the specific minutiae of what happens in that game situation when you actually get a takeaway and an opportunity to put points on the board defensively. It's just this most recent evolution of how coaching is really get ingrained in the details of each situation.
I think the actual rule is now, and this is, I'm not making this up, I believe this is, it's in the rule, that on a turnover, the quarterback is considered a defenseless player. I mean, just right off the get. I mean, it's not even like, he is considered a defenseless player in terms of that. And I'm like, being a defensive guy, I'm like, well, you know what, then? If the ball's turned over, he should run off the field then. Yeah, he needs to run off the field then. Because I don't know. I didn't even know how I would coach this day. I mean, if that defenseless, the quarterback is the he's the safety back there. He's the one that's going to stop it. So if he's making any effort at all, I'm coaching my guys up to tee off, but yet you can't. I think he gets defenseless player designation as soon as the ball's turned over now.
Right. You cannot go cut that guy in half. You can't go make sure you actually get in position to secure that he's not going to actually attempt to make a tackle, because at that point, if he's out there, he's one of the 11. He is allowed to go actually make the play on the ball. He's just not allowed to go actually tea kettle that guy if he's in a position where he is. Because you're right, the designation of the QB does turn into defenseless until he actually gets to the point where he's attempting to make a tackle. If he gets there and he's in position, he's pursuing the football, you're allowed to block him. As a defender, you just need to be careful with how physical you are within that block, because they are looking for opportunities to try and throw a flag. So really, the focal points turn out to be who you have on the quarterback and who do you have on that most dangerous man. The receiver who's actually intended for the football that the quarterback throws it to, that's usually termed as the most dangerous man, because that's the guy where when the defender gets the interception, if somebody gets that OSCE, is the term that tends to be used with most schemes, you get an OSCE. Defender starts to run in the opposite direction, that receiver who is intended for the football is likely right near that defensive back who gets the INT. So he's in a chase position. He can come up and be one of those guys to poke the ball away or strip the ball away from behind when that defensive back, who likely isn't very used to carrying the football in space anyway, may not have it secured away properly. So he's got an opportunity to strip it and try to get it back for the opposing offense. So somebody who was on defense, now turning the offense off the turnover, has to become the blocker for that most dangerous man. So there's someone assigned for every area of the field when the defense actually gets a takeaway. And that's part of why we're seeing so many more of those plays get made. Not just because defenders are getting more athletic and their skill set maybe suits both sides of the football with ball skills and, the way that they can wiggle in and out of space and a lot of defensive backs being returned men and that sort of thing, but also because it's being coached with detail of how we actually not only secure the takeaway, but try and put this football in the end zone.
Did you get any of those first two games for the Pac-12 Network, the game at Utah or the game at Arizona State?
I have a game at Arizona State. That's my opening week. My crew, myself, Roxy Bernstein, and Lewis Johnson. And, you know, Roxy's really well known. He does a lot of ESPN basketball, and he does a lot of college football on the West Coast over a number of years. And myself and Roxy and Lewis have made up the, you know, the number one team, the A team for the Pac-12 Network for the last couple of seasons. So I have a lot of fun working with Roxy in the booth. And then all your listeners have seen Lewis Johnson with all the track coverage that he does with NBC, yeah, being down on the sideline and interviewing Usain Bolt after he's breaking world records and all this kind of stuff. So we've got an excellent crew, and, you know, Pac-12 Network is available on almost all your major cable and satellite carriers and all those things. And so even though your listenership may mainly be down south, you can watch some Pac-12 football. And I do have Arizona State opening up on Thursday night in that week one, but also got USC. So I got a fun opening weekend between both those schools.
Oh, so you got the USC game as well on Saturday. So that's good stuff. All right, that's going to be
– yeah, we get a nice little double dip. And it's going to be a fun weekend because there's a lot kind of circling around that Arizona State program, and they've got a New Mexico State crew that's coming in on that Thursday night. So we would assume Arizona State should handle that one. But USC facing Western Michigan, while Western Michigan has lost a lot of offensive talent from their undefeated team last year, but, you know, it's a new staff that's come in. They got a lot of players who've returned and running back and defensively. So Western Michigan is not going to be just an easy out in the opening game for USC. I think the Trojans should end up controlling that ball game, but this isn't just some throwaway game against some FCS team. Western Michigan played well in a bowl game, went undefeated last year, so they got real players.
Yeah, but they lost their oars, man. They're not rowing the boat anymore. USC will blow them out. They got no oars anymore. All right, man.
Are you entertained by PJ Fleck? Do you like all the rowing?
You know what? I love the guy. I love the guy. I mean, I really do. I think it's going to be very interesting to see what he can do with Minnesota, because there's a ceiling at Minnesota. Minnesota is like Mississippi State. You know what I mean? They're like old. They're like these teams. There's a certain ceiling there that, you know, they can't get into that upper crust. But if anybody's going to do some damage, he'll do some damage there before he takes over, you know, at Ohio State when Urban decides to retire again. So I really like the guy a lot. I know it's corny, but I like the guy.
Yeah, and corny isn't always bad. Some folks are into corny. You know, different strokes for different folks, different ways to row the boat. That's how it usually goes.
He's rowing the boat. Now, me, I'm a motorboat kind of guy. I mean, I like to put a big 250 back there, like Yamaha 250 back there myself. But if you're going to row the boat, you know, PJ Fleck is the guy. All right, I appreciate you as always, man, and we'll look forward to talking next week. We got games next week. We got Pac-12 games next week. We got actual games that we'll be talking about. So I look forward to doing it again.
Finally here.
Yeah, it's here, man.
Season of the pilots. Like I mentioned, I'll be in Spokane, landing there, and then heading over to Pullman. So tomorrow, as I'm getting my meals out west, folks can follow me on Twitter. Use the hashtag AntBites. I can let you know what I'm doing as far as where I'm eating before I go check out practice.
Like that. Hashtag AntBites. All right, man. Appreciate it. We'll do it again.
Big diggity. See you next week.
Anthony Hearn. All right, let's get a break. It's the Tom Abraham Show. 730-1039. Yep.
Sports Radio 730 and 1039. The Op. WUMP.